Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, do we have any eyewitness accounts of the Southside Irish Parade yesterday? Give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. And the reason I ask is because I understand, and I think we have some audio to provide evidence of this, that Governor Spaulding and Mayor Triple Threat, the four-tool mayor, were not received well by the Southside denizens during their, well, I guess, walk through the parade. And that's another question I have about what happened with Jelly Belly, because I understand he had to be pulled off of his float, and that's no small task, because he was not only being booed, but he was being pelted with candy. And so for safety reasons, he got pulled off his float. But then he can't walk the parade route and risk breaking a femur or two. So did they have, does Bentley make a rascal? Did they have some other vehicle for him, some sort of Pope mobile for the governor?
No. So after I tweeted, because I was bombarded with information, like, oh, my God, they got booed. He was being thrown items at him and candy. He was walking the entire parade route, which I find very circumspect. But then if you look at the video, he was walking. He did get booed. You don't see in the clips that we saw candy being thrown at him, but eyewitnesses said that it was happening. This is Pritzker being booed.
The crowd is booing for Governor Pritzker here.
Narration. So
it was not.
Were they saying fresh fish like Shawshank? What were they saying?
I don't know what they were chanting. We do want to hear from people that were there. 312-642-5600, turnkey depro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
How did he walk the parade route? Does he have some sort of leg? Did he have leg braces on? Was he leaning on some sort of motorized vehicle?
No. And the day before, he walked the Southside Irish Parade downtown, but nobody was there to boo anybody downtown.
You sure it wasn't like he didn't have a hoverboard or something? I can't imagine you would take a risk. I mean, maybe he's in re-election shape.
I don't know. Somebody did ask me if he was losing weight, because they saw a shot from him from behind and texted me and said, is he losing some LBs, some pounds, trying to get it together, trying to bring it in for the election? But Mayor Lightfoot, she actually had, yes, for that is confirmed, she had to leave because she was absolutely destroyed out there. People the entire time.
Yeah, okay. Well, destroyed, that's a little over the top. Oh my, it's like a YouTube headline. Flame, dude, destroyed, decimated.
She had to leave.
So what?
Well, she had to get off the route because it was a safety issue. She made it from 103rd to 105th, and then they called it. Her people said, that's it, get out of here. Put her in a golf cart. Well, they put her in a golf cart and then had bike patrol surround her to get to her motorcade so that she could leave.
Uh-huh. Yes. Did she wear that same leprechaun getup for the parade that she had on at some function downtown?
No, she wore
that.
Yeah, I think the world saw that, Dan. That was
well. I mean,
quite
I understand. You know, when you're walking around with a tool like hers, you got to put a kilt over it. But I just thought. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to be received in the Irish community.
Yeah, it's just, you don't dress up like that, ever. But as somebody tweeted out that she needed the white socks to hide her package. Because, you know, she had the high white socks up to her knees that she
Thanks
needed.
Thanks for explaining it.
You're welcome.
Mo and Lyons, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you were saying that people throwing candy at Pritzker, you know, they had to pull him off the float. I was wondering just how many people were mistaking Pritzker for the float.
Exactly right. Thanks for the call, Mo. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know that they were throwing candy at him to ridicule him or as a means of protest. They were just throwing candy at him because he looked hungry.
Oh, right, right.
He likes candy. I mean, look at him. He's got
like
a sweet tooth.
To eat.
Yeah.
But that says a lot. And Pritzker, I mean, Meyer Lifeson got booed more so, I think, than JB because of what's happening today with all the police officers and city employees who are going to lose their jobs because they're not vaccinated. So that, you know, people are letting her know that that's not cool and we don't like you and you shouldn't run for reelection.
Yeah, the it's sort of amazing the hubris of going down to the South. How did you think you were going to be received by the residents of Mount Greenwood and Beverly and, you know, the Southwest Side, Evergreen Park in Oklahoma? Did you think you were going to be received well?
Yeah. Remember this? Remember when they went to the home opener for the White Sox and they thought they were going to get a great standing ovation and people love them? Pritzker throwing out the first pitch. Remember that? Because they're so tone deaf. They think that, oh, everybody loves us. They want to see us. They want to celebrate us. Well, guess what? They don't.
Well, maybe they do now. And by the way, they're lucky the Legu boys weren't out there yesterday because it could have got ugly.
Oh, the Legu.
That father-son team. Maybe it's not that they don't understand it. Maybe they sort of use this in a way that we're not perceiving. Maybe they think, I know I'm going to take heat down there, but I'm going to show, number one, that I can take heat. And then I'm going to demonstrate, you know, these are the people that are against us when I go to my actual constituents on the lakefront, you know, in the identitarian community. So this is my way of saying, look at these, you know, Southside goons who persecute me for standing up for you. You know, think through this a little bit. It probably does make some sense. It's a nice talking point for them to play the persecution game with their actual constituents, their actual voters. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. And thank
you. Were you at the parade?
Wasn't there, but I had neighbors that were there.
Yeah.
And they told me, they said they were, one of the things that we're calling them, both of them, was a tyrant and everything, and that the sentiment of the people was, how dare you come here? You destroyed our country, and I mean our city. You destroyed our city here and everything. And then you basically go up, and that they tried to get on, she tried to get on two floats. She tried to get on she was trying to get on a float or something, and they wouldn't let her get on it or something. They grabbed her.
Maybe she just needed a boost, you know. She couldn't get up to the float. Thanks for the call, Craig.
And when you have a great outfit like the one she donned on Saturday, repeat it, girlfriend. You don't just keep that in for one parade. You got to wear it to the second one. Why not?
Well, don't forget, I mean,
please.
She likes to, this is a mayor who likes to play dress up.
Oh, that's
You know, when we're talking about a Rona Buster.
Oh, yeah.
She likes the funny videos, including with her wife, Amy, there, who's ravishing.
Gorgeous. Did you see her outfit? That was very appropriate for Saturday's event.
Who,
she wore
her,
a pantsuit. Her
no, I didn't see
yes,
that.
Yes, with a green scarf.
I'm sure it was
very lovely.
Smart.
Yes.
Yeah, very smart. We got in trouble. We got a call on Friday when we started talking about triple threats. You know, penis.
The
biggest one in town, as I understand. And then somebody made a Michelle Obama comment.
I did, because I said she was beautiful.
Well, but somebody made a comment about Michelle Obama packing as well, and then we sort of had a little bit of fun with that. And somebody was just sort of offended by that, like a listener.
We
like,
have it
you know,
here. Do you want to hear it?
No, I don't. And so this idea, like, oh, you know, this is you can't go there, and what? Why?
He was mad that you called Jelly Belly. Stop you saying Jelly Belly. You've been saying that for, where has he been? You've been saying that for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, let me try this again, especially if this gentleman who called and was critical listens to the show regularly. How many times do I have to explain this? Just so you're clear on my position, which should be your position. No one is above ridicule. Particularly these politicians in this city and state who bring so much of it upon themselves. But regardless, No one is above reproach or above ridicule, particularly, especially, are you listening? Especially people in power. It reminds both us and them that they are our temporary representatives, not our permanent betters. Are you listening? So if you want to make a case for why, you know, civility and this and that, and nobody gets a nickname and nobody gets made fun of when they're screaming at a park district attorney about they got the biggest dong in town, you want to say, well, that's off limits. Let's raise it to a higher level. No, let's not. I can go to the higher level. You hear it on this show all the time as well. We can go as dry and esoteric and intellectual as you want. And there's not a lot of people up there. Number one. Number two, it's called modulation. You need to go there and be serious and substantive sometimes, but you also need to remind people who they are and where they are, that nobody lords over anybody else, or should at least. And in this city and state that suffers from the most virulent strain of Stockholm syndrome, this side of Sweden, boy, it's that much more important, isn't it? So that's my response, again, to the critics who think that somebody is off limits. No one. No one in public office. No adult or even minor who makes a public spectacle of themselves, like, for example, Greta Thunberg comes to mind. No one like that is off limits. And if you have a problem, then don't send a call into the station. Let's hash it out on the air.
Don't call our boss.
I mean, it's fine. You can call our boss, too. I don't care, but it's just boring to do it that way. Stand and deliver. Jim in Crown Point.
The original plan was to float Pritzker above the crowd like a Macy's Day balloon.
Yeah.
But it was too windy, so he came down. And they were throwing candy at him, but he was unwrapping it and eating it. And I think he got sick, and that's why they pulled him out of there.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Jim.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Dan and Amy, this installment of Sports and Politics, we tackle two legends.
Yeah, where were you when you heard the news?
About Kevin Durant?
No,
Kevin Durant is one of them. Tom Brady, of course, is the other.
Yes. Longest Brady, 6 weeks of my life.
Tom Brady is back, he tweeted.
Oh, my God.
You know, I don't know. There's not much to say about that other than, I guess.
Did he ever really leave your heart?
I guess he isn't going to go down this way. And by that, I mean, he is sensitive enough to focus on his legendary status rather than becoming sort of a sad punchline. And I'm talking about the movie that we mentioned he was going to be starring in, 80 for Brady, with Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Rita Moreno.
Stop. Please stop. Can we stop the production of this?
Where three octogenarian gals go on a road trip to see their favorite player, Tom Brady, play in the Super Bowl.
Please stop.
The hijinks ensue.
Please stop right now.
You can't go from the mountaintop to that, I guess. He must have stared into the abyss and he blinked. Thank goodness for him.
Well, he tweeted, the past 2 months, I think we need music with this. The past 2 months, I've realized my place is still on the field and not in the stands. That time will come, but it's not now. I love my teammates. I love my supportive family. They make it all possible. I'm coming back for my 23rd season in Tampa. Unfinished business, LFG.
Yeah, I wonder how much that had to do with, like, Aaron Rodgers signing that fat contract and he's going to play into his 40s. And,
I just didn't like that. I thought a lot of men, because I listen to sports radio often, I check in, were, you know, just vilified his wife, saying, you know, his wife made him retire.
How can
nobody knows that.
How can people listen to sports radio? That's unlistenable. I mean, it's like watching the NBA. If you like basketball, how are you a basketball fan and you watch the NBA? It's unwatchable. It's not basketball. It's a glorified shoot around. As much as I, you know, admire the athletic ability of the Kevin Durants of the world, it's just not good basketball. But sports radio, that is the dumbest form of communication that is available. Maybe just slightly above Howard Stern.
Well, I don't listen to it often, but I'm a big Tom Brady fan, and so is our family. So I wanted to tune in to see what, you know, what's the real reason why I retire. And there are people that called in and said his wife made him do it. You know, Bungie. She made him retire. And
I think
her
name's Giselle.
Giselle Bungie. Yeah.
All right. I mean, you know, what is there to say about Tom Brady? He's coming out of retirement. He wants to play. He's football 24/7 for 25, 30 years almost, when you include his collegiate career.
Please don't make that movie. That's all I ask.
Yeah, the movie. It was just. I think he said, "Am I really going to become this sort of caricature of myself by participating in these ghastly movies?" It's one thing to have like a cameo, like a Brett Favre in There's Something About Mary.
Yeah.
And it's another thing to be trying to yuck it up with these octogenarian, you know.
Because Brady really wasn't that good in Ted 2. I mean, he made a cameo. You know?
Neither was Mark Wahlberg.
Neither was the teddy bear.
All right. So on a more
serious thing.
More important intersection between sports and politics, per the segment. Kevin Durant, so he poured in 53 yesterday. And at the post-game presser, he was asked about this bizarre circumstance. You know, Durant plays for the Brooklyn Nets. Mm-hmm. So does Kyrie Irving. No longer Russian oligarch owned, by the way. And Kyrie Irving, remember, can't play because there is a private employer vax mandate still in effect in New York.
Right, so he can play at away games, but he can't play at home games, the Brooklyn Net home games, due to the fact that he's unvaccinated.
But he can attend those games, which he did yesterday.
It's awesome.
He was in the stands. He gets a standing ovation as he's
so
walking
ridiculous.
In. And so Kevin Durant was asked about that after the game, and he took out after the silliness of it all, and he named names, starting with New York City Mayor Eric Adams.
It's ridiculous. Like, I don't understand it at all. I mean, there's a few people in our arena that's unvaxxed, right? Like, they lifted all of that in our arena, right? So what's the, I don't get it.
It's a second mandate that says he can come in but can't play.
Yeah, I don't get it. It just feels like at this point now, somebody's trying to make a statement or a point to flex their authority. But, you know, everybody out here is looking for attention, and that's what I feel like the mayor wants right now, some attention, you know. But he'll figure it out soon. He better. But it just didn't make any sense. Like, there's unvaxxed people in this building already. Mm-hmm. We got a guy who can come into the building. I guess, are they fearing our safety? I don't get it. So, yeah, we're all confused. Pretty much everybody in the world is confused at this point. Early on in the season, you know, people didn't understand what was going on, but now it just looks stupid. So hopefully, Eric, you got to figure this out.
They should just they should boycott a game, the entire team. We're not playing until Kyrie Irving can play.
Andy in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hello.
Hey, Andy.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to say that Biden inflation is so bad that Brady had to go back to work.
Hey,
Thanks, Andy. Is Kevin Durant right? Is he right that doesn't make any sense? Kyrie Irving can come watch a Brooklyn Nets game, but Kyrie Irving can't play for the Brooklyn Nets?
So I expect
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA turnkey.pro text line. Before you give Kevin Durant an attaboy, say Kevin Durant is making sense, before you give him a little slap on the backside, listen to Michael Wilbon, Chicago's very own,
yes,
Northwestern grad.
Yes, he is.
Olympia Fields Country Club member.
Oh, he is. Didn't know that.
Yeah, I don't get it. It just feels like at this point now, somebody's trying to make a statement or a point to flex their authority.
Okay.
But, you know,
you'll hear Wilbon.
Everybody out here is looking for attention, and that's what I feel like
the mayor wants right now, some attention, you know?
All right, Michael, what about how do we react to that?
Kevin Durant is too aware and too plugged in to say something that impertinent.
What?
What's the point of that? Want some attention? You want to call out somebody? Call out your teammate. Tell him to get a shot. Because he's got plenty of them, because he could have gone to grade school in metropolitan New York without vaccines. I mean, all these guys want to be so irresponsible and not accountable enough to look at this dude and tell him, you want to play with us? Get a shot. Put a shot in your arm. The vaccine is not about attention. People died, hundreds of thousands of them, from this virus. And you think the mayor of New York needs to attend to a basketball team's needs, your needs, before he needs to attend to the needs of a metropolitan area, the biggest in America? Are you kidding me? Kevin Durant, there's some knuckleheads who would say stuff like this. I'd probably let it go. Kevin Durant is too smart and too plugged in. Everybody wants to tell you how woke they are, and then I gotta hear something like that? That's offensive. Stop.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Who's right, Kevin Durant or Michael Wilbon?
He needs to get a grip, man. Has he read any latest science and data on this? It's over. It is. COVID is over. I mean, yes, President Obama got it. He's going to be fine. But that is none of his gosh darn business whether or not Kyrie Irving gets vaccinated or not. And he shouldn't be ripping on Kevin Durant because he's supporting his teammate. Oh, my God. That is disturbing.
What do you mean it's over? There were more deaths in the United States on March 10th from COVID of 2022 than March 10th of 2021.
Oh, I don't believe any of these COVID deaths. I don't. Because people that I know that have died from pancreatic cancer, they put them down as a COVID death. I don't want to go there, but
Michael. On Kevin Durant, did Kevin Durant say anything about the mayor of New York tending to his needs or to the needs of the Brooklyn Nets? No. He said that it doesn't make sense. Explain to me the rationale behind Kyrie Irving can attend a Nets game, he can sit courtside. But he can't walk on the court and play with us.
So stupid. Only away games. That's it.
So what is the basis for that, Michael Wilbon? Since you're so passionate about this issue, explain the science. Explain your position. Why is Kevin Durant wrong when he says that doesn't make sense?
Well, other large corporations have changed their ways. American Airlines hiring back the unvaccinated. United Airlines doing the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Wilbon is a good example of the COVIDian that you're never going to reach.
Yep.
The
amen.
The doctrinaire leftist, and Wilbon is, and he's an inveterate race hustler. He's a very angry guy.
Oh, he's so angry. I had dinner with him one time, and it was awful. I couldn't wait to leave.
Okay, why?
Because he was yelling at his wife. We were at a table. We were at a Dan Patrick's roast. And I was sitting next to him and his wife, and he was so rude to her. It was just uncomfortable. Nobody wants to hear a couple fighting during dinner, but he didn't stop, and he was insufferable. Ugh. Not a happy person, years ago,
yeah,
but still
I don't,
not happy.
I mean, it's a good example. By the way, when I say talk radio, I would include all these ghastly ESPN shows. I don't know how anybody watches them. I don't know how anybody watches Pardon the Interruption, him and Kornheiser.
Oh, I can't watch them.
I don't know how anybody watches these roundtable discussions. They're as bad or worse than these Sunday talk shows with, the Chuck Todds and
they're worse than
Margaret
them.
Brennan's of the world and the Clinton Foundation Donor Zero and so forth. This is you shed IQ points listening to this stuff. But anyway, people do. The whole moral indignation in the direction of Kevin Durant because people have died. Well, what does that have to do with what Kevin Durant, the point that Kevin Durant made? I don't see how it has anything to do with it. Joe in Mundelein, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Love you guys' show. I just wanted to say that the visitors who come into New York, if they're not vaccinated, they're allowed to play. So that's where
exactly
kind of iffy. You know, it's just ridiculous, really.
Yeah,
unvaxxed player. That's right. I forgot to mention that unvaxxed players can go to New York and play. We have that rule here too, and it's Chicago.
Well, because it's the private employer mandate, so the employer is the Brooklyn Nets. They don't have dominion over, you know, Eric Adams doesn't have dominion over the Chicago Bulls. So, I mean, I understand. So that would be the explanation, but that still doesn't address Kevin Durant's point, which is a very commonsensical one. And when you can't address the commonsensical point, you just go into histrionics like Michael Wilbon. He does the same thing when it comes to race issues all the time. I can't wait to see him in the locker room at Olympia Field someday.
Oh.
Tony in Downers Grove.
Can I come too?
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, I know you've come full circle, but quit saying that COVID's over. It's not over. Okay, we know we can live with it, but it's not over. Dan, here's the thing. Michael Wilbon just exemplifies all of sports talk radio because this is what they spout. This is what they carry, and it's the ideology of a certain group of people. But they've been doing this for 2 years, and you know. They need to
justify what they've been saying for 2 years, even at the expense of making any sense, like you heard from Wilbon, is your point.
But Dan, they've been doing that. But I think it's important to listen to the Dunciad to have a feel as to where they're going. But I will say this: there was a time when there was a great sports show, and it was the Roundtable, if you remember it.
The sports writers on TV.
That's correct. And that was a good sport.
That was a great show. That was a great show. Thanks for the call, Tony. And that even includes sort of insufferable leftist telender. But Gleason and Bentley and Joust was left too. But they were so entertaining and, you know, so crusty and just from a different era. It was so interesting. I love the sports writers on TV, but there's nothing like that. It's like recalling Loving Firing Line, but there's nothing like that anymore.
Right.
Or even Crossfire, and there's nothing like that anymore. There's nothing interesting in the political space or the sports space. And when it comes to these talk shows, I can't think of anything interesting, honestly. I mean,
there's nothing out there.
But the other thing you have to understand about the sports press corps, when everything has become so politicized, all aspects of life have become politicized in America. And I've said this many times, but it seems like a perfect opportunity to repeat it. I mean, these sports journalists like Wilbon and these people that take themselves so seriously.
Yeah.
They want to be taken seriously. So how do I get taken seriously? I have to throw in with the politics of the political press corps. What's the politics of the political press corps? 90% plus are dyed-in-the-wool leftists.
Right.
And so that's what they do. You hear it on Chicago sports radio, too. And of course, on ESPN, you know, Disney owned ESPN, of course, this is the culture. These are cultural mavens. They aspire to be cultural mavens. They aspire to be important. They aspire to, you know, get a seat on one of these unwatchable shows. And the way you do that is if you're not already a committed leftist, you become one because it pays to do so. Simple as that. And what you see with almost every show on sports talk or ESPN is that playing out in real time. And Wilbon and Kornheiser, who were, you know, part of the pantheon of these sports talkers, I guess, are, you know, prima facie evidence of that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So some postscript on Jussie Smollett. His performance at sentencing last week did not
earn him an Oscar,
but it did earn him a visit to the psych ward. You know what we're talking about.
No, I would just like to say to Your Honor that I'm not suicidal. That's what I would like to say.
Okay.
I'm not suicidal.
Okay.
I am not suicidal.
You're what?
I am innocent.
and I am not suicidal. If I did this, then it means that I stuck my fist in the fears of Black Americans in this country for over 400 years and the fears of the LGBTQ community. Your Honor, I respect you and I respect the jury, but I did not do this, and I am not suicidal. And if anything happens to me when I go in there, I did not do it to myself, and you must all know that. I respect you, Your Honor. I respect your decision. Jail time?
Ooh, now you crossed the line.
I am not suicidal.
And scene. All right. That's a wrap, everybody.
Thanks for coming on. Key Grip, great job today.
Really. Well done. Yes. Well done. Now his brother is upset that Jesse is... been referred to the psych ward.
Well, because they're upset, too, because they thought the judge was grandstanding. Because he, you know, for a half hour, he went on about, you know, how you're an adverb now for lying. And he went, it was great.
Yeah, you're
a charlatan, blah, blah, blah. But you know, it's the judge's fault. This isn't Jesse's fault.
He spoke about his arrogance. He doesn't know the struggles my brother is encountering. Okay. He doesn't know anything that he's dealing with. He spent all that time shaming him. In 2022, we don't shame people like this.
All right?
He basically called him a mental case. All right? If you look at that testimony, he basically reiterated and regurgitated all the prosecutors said. There was no independence. This is a duly elected judge in Cook County. He's supposed to be elected by the people, not just a stooge and a rubber stamp for the prosecutors. And I'm very disappointed. Very disappointed. My name is JoJo Smollett. I'm his oldest brother.
All right. Well, yeah, that's all interesting. I mean, all the pro forma statements from his brother's family, his supporters, Terrence Howard, who cares? But it is interesting, some comments on how this all went down, including that performance you've undoubtedly heard and seen by now from Juicy there at the end. Jason Whitlock was on Tucker Carlson's show. Jason Whitlock, sports journalist, one of the few that actually is a real
sports
journalist, thought leader, not part of the groupthink within the press corps, political and sports. And I thought he offered some interesting insights, as he usually does, but I disagree with this assessment that he made of what the Smollett case means. Take a listen.
So many people, from Jesse Jackson to the NAACP, to so many people in the elite so-called civil rights movement, social justice movement, attach their credibility to that guy, narcissist with a dark side who did something really heinous here, who clearly is starved for attention. They attached so much of their credibility to him. I felt like what we just saw from Jesse when his sentence was rendered was like that movement, the social justice warrior movement, the civil rights movement. Were these the death throes for Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, the NAACP? Because I'm just not sure how you attach your credibility to that guy, and he makes a clown out of himself and you. I don't know how you survived that. This was the craziest thing I've ever seen in a courtroom and on TV. I'm just blown away by the acting display and the nutty display from Jesse Smollett. And I feel sorry for all the idiots that leapt to his defense and were crying for mercy. This is a bad day for the grievance industrial complex.
Yeah, I agree it was a bad day for the grievance industrial complex. But to his previous point, this is the death throes of the old guard of race hustlers. You heard him, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, the NAACLCP, as Limbaugh used to call it, National Association for the Advancement of Liberal Colored People, Leftist Colored People.
They read a letter from the president, you know, begging for mercy, and Jesse Jackson was there. It was
BLM, right?
Yeah.
All the Marxists were out. So, that's the question. That's the actual question, the vagaries of Jesse Smollett's time in behind bars and his career and so forth. Who cares? The question, this is the death throes. This is the final nails as it pertains to those race hustlers of a bygone era. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Whitlock posed it as a question, but he was really more making a statement, maybe a hopeful statement that it is. But, I mean, of course, they've survived many frauds before.
But this one's so obvious. I mean, do they really, Samuel L. Jackson, the actor, they read a letter in court that he wrote, they really believe this bull jive that he was attacked by two MAGA-wearing people that threw bleach on him and put a noose around his neck? It's hard to process that they're going along, and his family, too, and his grandmas took the stand, and everyone thinks that he really got attacked. There's people that still think that.
Samuel Jackson recently said, looking back on his Oscar nomination, that black actors only win Oscars for one reason, when they do something bad or violent on screen. You know, Denzel wins for Training Day. That's what he thinks. So it's only when blacks are do something violent or portray a diabolical character that they get nominated or win Oscars. Really, it's interesting because I believe Sidney Poitier won an Oscar, the first black actor to do so, for Lilies of the Field. And that was not a dark character that he played there. But, you know, and that was, what, 1964? But, okay, Sam Jackson. So is that, are we done with that? The sort of statements from Sam Jackson? Obviously not.
No.
Are we done with Sharpton and Jackson and the race, the grievance industrial complex that Whitlock referenced? Why is Jesse Smollett, why would Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton not get away with Jesse Smollett and continue on to their next shakedown? How would that be any different than getting away with Tawana Brawley? Al Sharpton got away with Tawana Brawley not only without incident, he went on to fame and fortune from there.
Yeah. Well, if Jesse Smollett keeps his nose clean, he'll be out by May 26th. And I was so, you know, like, oh yeah, he should go to jail. Now I've completely changed my mind. Because we have 93 plus people in Chicago who are alleged rapists, murderers, armed robbers, you know, carjackers that are out on electronic monitoring.
Do you think that's a space issue?
No, it's a manpower issue. I mean, they have to protect Jesse Smollett. They don't have solitary confinement, according to Tom Dart. They got rid of that in 2016. But if he's in the psych ward, he's separated from general pop.
I don't understand your point. So he should be in prison. He shouldn't be in prison.
He shouldn't,
why shouldn't he be in prison.
He spent the weekend in jail. Let him out.
Why shouldn't he be in prison?
Because it's a nonviolent offense, and we have violent people that are on the streets right now as we speak with electronic monitoring.
So white collar criminals shouldn't go to prison?
No, get him out of here. Get him out of Chicago. I'm done with this. People on Jesse Smollett watch. You know, is he going to stub his toe in prison? And it's just. There's two different levels.
Putting violent criminals behind bars and putting Jesse Smollett behind bars, those things are not mutually exclusive. You can do both. You should do both. And the reason he should get prison time, if I was a judge, I would have given the max sentence, is because of that performance. There's no contrition. There's no remorse. Number one. Number two is to send a message, since this has become a bit of an industry, these race hoaxes. You know, our friend Will Riley down at Kentucky State wrote a book about it. We've had him on the show to discuss, because we have a culture now where playing the victim gets you status and oftentimes compensated. And so you have all of these race hoaxes, and people are not punished for trying to run these scams. And why should they not be punished for running a scam like this that wastes other people's resources any more than anybody else running a scam, an online scam, the Nigerian prince scam or whatever it is? These are just scam artists. Why should they not serve prison time.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
The electronic monitoring, violent criminals out on electronic monitoring, that's a policy decision. That's not a resource decision.
Okay.
So you can do both and you should do both. But why this grievance, these race hustlers, that they're now a bygone era? Maybe Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, just because they've aged out and they're being backfilled by Black Lives Matter. But Black Lives Matter, and this is what I would say to Whitlock, the problem I have the same hope that he does. The problem is Black Lives Matter, which is ascendant and flush with cash, they weighed in on this. They're not interested in stopping these scams. In fact, they're more ideological than Sharpton and Jackson. Mainly just wanted to line their pockets. Now you have people want to line their pockets, but they're also Marxist ideologues. It's actually getting worse, I think, than it was during the height of the Jackson-Sharpton era. So no, I don't think this Jussie Smollett reckoning changes anything when it comes to this race grievance industry, because it's more ubiquitous than it's ever been. Look at corporate America. You know, by the way, who's financing Black Lives Matter at a level Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton can only dream of during their heyday? Jason in Northlake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. It's not dead. These are not the death throes. If anything, it's the death throes of the old tactics. But, you know, we're at the dawn of a new age of these scams. And I totally agree with you, too, that you need to stop it. You need to punish the people that are pulling these scams, because they're going unpunished. So there's a zero risk, 100% reward gain to pulling these kind of race hustles and scams. And it all started back when Al Sharpton was lionized, even after it was found out that that whole rape case was a fraud. And yeah, he's still on MSNBC. And right, he's still a hero of the left. And white,
how about Jesse Jackson going down to, how about Jesse Jackson when he went down to that high school in Decatur? And made a spectacle of himself and lied about what happened with that fight between the kids at that high school. Nothing happened. Thanks for the call, Jason. And what do you hear from them when they get caught? Oh, or they're apologists. You hear, you know, yeah, but. Yeah, Jesse pulled a scam and that was wrong, but.
But this is, you know, gay black men are under attack. Exactly. I remember him saying that one. You're like, what? Okay, who?
No, but that's what they do.
Talk to me.
But the larger issue, he points to a larger issue that's very real, and then they go right back to their identitarian rap.
And they had to throw Trump supporters in there.
Lee Hammond.
Hey, guys. You know, what he should have went to jail for was the fact that, and I very seldom ever hear anybody talk about this like you're saying, is that he tried to perpetrate a hoax that conservatives and Trump supporters are a bunch of homophobic racists.
Right.
You know, and if you want to talk about Al Sharpton, what about Freddie's Fashion, Mark, where he got people killed, and yet there's no accountability for these clowns. And yet they're, like you said, they're put on a pedestal. What kind of society is this that allows that kind of thing to get away? These people get away with these things.
Thanks for the call, Lee. I mean, think about where we're at. You know, congratulations, Amy, on your Iowa Hawkeyes winning the Big Ten tourney.
Got boys and girls programs. Thank you.
Yeah. And the Hawkeyes jersey on the back has equality. How embarrassing. How silly. And that's where we're at. So who's winning? This is being peeled back now, or you expect it to be peeled back after Jesse Smollett self-immolated? No, I don't think so. Mike in Union.
Good morning. Yeah, the whole thing with Whitlock, and I thought you were going to go in the direction of why you disagreed with them, was that they lost credibility. But where is their credibility? They're all a bunch of corporate monsters. They don't have any street cred. They're just looking for street cred while, Samuel L. Jackson advertises MasterCard and or whatever and what's in your wallet while he gets everybody in debt. They don't have any street cred. It's such a scam. So.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, that's what it is. But, I mean, so, right, yeah, you're right. So you're saying, like, they have no credibility to lose because they're race hustlers. But I guess what Whitlock is trying to point out is, you know, they're going to be marginalized. They're not going to have the same access to media. I mean, because remember, these race hustlers are complete products of white media. Completely. The white power structure that they rail against and get paid off. That's their profession. Railing against the people that pay them off to shut up. Or at least to, you know, set their sights on someone else. That's the whole shakedown. Read Ken Timmerman's book on Jesse Jackson. The seminal work on Jesse Jackson called Shakedown. Not a reverend. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, what if two white guys happen to be stumbling out of a bar somewhere near there at that time? Cops pick them up. He says, oh, yeah, that's them. You know, then they're going to go through hell just because he made up something.
Thanks for the call,
Larry. Well, the Asandario brothers did. I mean, they were questioned for hours. Nabbed off a plane when they got back from Nigeria.
Well, they should have. They participated in a fraud.
They did, but they came clean. They said, you know, yeah, this was the script. This is a hoax. This is where, you know, we bought the rope here at the Crafty Beaver.
Yeah, right.
This.
Right. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Morning. In response to one of your previous callers, this is a society that has a lot of beta cuckolded males in it. Mm-hmm. That's what it has. A society that has fathers who don't stand up for their kids with having masks being put on them in schools. A society that allows these illegal and unconstitutional vaccine and other mandates being put on us. A society that doesn't have people who have enough time to be able to go and run for local office and care enough to be able to keep these communists out of our school boards. That's the kind of society this is, and we're reaping what we've sown all of these years. That's what it is. People don't care, or they're just beta cuckolded males, and we have a lot of them in society, and that's what it is.
Thanks, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before Mike Scott's Nudecast, we were discussing what kind of society do we have when people rally to defend race hustlers and hoaxers like Jussie Smollett. And the race-obsessed, race and identity-obsessed society we have, what kind of society is that going to be? What kind of society is it going to be where, as part of the core curriculum from pre-K through 12, and then, of course, into college, there are groups of people that are oppressors, there are groups of people that are victims, not based on any behavior, but based on their non-behavioral characteristics, like race, gender. Well, it's going to be this kind of society. A middle school in Coconut Creek, Florida. By the way, Coconut Creek, just outside of Fort Lauderdale. Great club there called Adios, Amy.
And how did it go? Did you say adios when you left?
I had fun. It's a great, great club.
But did you play well, Dan?
That's back when I was playing well.
Okay.
A while ago. I no longer can play golf. Here is what happened at a middle school in Coconut Creek.
Yeah, well, police say the accused kids attacked other students for being white here at this rec center behind me. I spoke with a parent of a suspect, and I spoke with a parent of a victim, both in defense of their child, both with two different takes on what happened.
I put my hands up so they don't whack my face and stuff. After they jumped me, they said, like, this is, like, revenge, what they did, like, in the 1700s.
Revenge for slavery.
According to Coconut Creek police, five students from Lions Creek Middle School are charged with a hate crime, accused of going after four other students. The reports say the students attacked, racially profiled the other kids for being white, allegedly using language like brown power and you are white.
It's so interesting, the reporting on this, too. Kids went after white kids, and they're being charged with a hate crime. So you mean black kids went after white kids?
Was it black kids going?
Are you not allowed to identify the race of the kids who are being charged with a hate crime? And you're saying the police report indicates that it was racially motivated, as that one kid who was the subject of the beating described. Here's the parent of one of the kids accused.
Shocking, because he's never in trouble.
Not my boy.
Secondly, I feel like they're trying to ruin these kids' lives.
One of the dads of the kids attacked.
They can't do anything to the other kids because it didn't happen on school property. He wants to go back to school there because all his friends are there, but he doesn't feel safe. There's an opportunity to move out, but that seems like a punishment.
Happened at a rec center. Now, when we have hazing off campus, what was that Glenbrook case? Was it softball
North.
Team or volleyball
the
team?
The Powder Puff.
Powder Puff football team or whatever?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Girl-on-girl bullying. And that was off campus, right?
Yeah, it was in the Forest Preserve.
And that becomes a national story.
Oh, sure did.
Anytime you have a hate crime alleged where the perpetrator is white and the alleged victim is black, that's a national story. How much attention do you think this story is going to get?
I've never heard of it before.
No, I don't think any of the kids were seriously injured, thankfully. But the backdrop of it is interesting. The way it's covered is interesting. All you have to sort of cover this story, but we're going to cover it very carefully, consistent with identitarian guideposts. We won't identify the race of the alleged perpetrators, and the NBC affiliate did not, including in its write-up. We'll hear from a parent who we won't identify as black, even though you can see on the screen that she's black. You can't say black. You can't say white. What about the underlying basis of the alleged attack? This is for what you did in the 1700s. Where does that come from? Is that something those kids at that one middle school outside of Fort Lauderdale just dreamt up? Or is that part of what is being indoctrinated into kids at the pre-K through 12 level all over the country? And the idea that you have license to demand recompense or take it. What have we seen with Black Lives Matter and some of those individuals affiliated with that organization? How have they demonstrated their approach to racial justice in this country over the last 2 years as they've laid siege to cities across America? So the whole, what are we teaching our kids? You know, everything is for the kids, and what kind of example we're setting for the kids, and it's fairness and it's justice and it's equal treatment before the law. And it's all these sort of laudable things. That's the patina of the curriculum, of the rhetoric, of the ideology. This is how it actually plays out. And you say, well, this is a rather innocuous incident. This is some kids get in a scrape with some other kids. But if this was reversed, of course, this would be an indication of the systemic racism that still faces black kids in America.
You'd have every BLM activist, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, everybody would be in Coconut Creek.
Yeah, they'd burn the thing down. They fly right down from the Jesse Smollett sentencing, mm-hmm. where they were flacking for him to flack for them. They may anyway. You know, the mom who says this is just about ruining their lives. I don't believe in hate crime laws. I think they're silly.
Right. You've always said that. And I can't remember the last time black kids were charged with a hate crime.
Well, I mean, the
beating
argument.
Beating up white kids because of slavery?
The argument is often that minorities can't be racist because racism requires being in power, and since this is a white supremacist society and a white patriarchal power structure, it's impossible for minorities to be racist. Okay. I mean, this is the argument you get from the Marxist, the new Marxist left, the identitarians. And so I'm sure you'll have some say, well, these kids shouldn't be charged with a hate crime. That's a felony. Should they be charged with a hate crime? Felony. No, 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 no. Trying to ruin my kid's life. Would they be saying the same thing if it was a white kid who said, we should go back to slavery and beat up a black kid or a bunch of white kids beating up a bunch of black kids? They said something that to justify it in their mind, and they beat up a bunch of black kids. What would the response be? Hate crime charges? Justified? Well, what about as vengeance for slavery in the 1700s? Justified? Hate crime prosecution? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is the kind of culture you want in K-12. Because if you want it in K-12, then you're going to have it everywhere. And that's what we have. And this is where it goes. And it's, you know, fists in this case, thankfully only fists. It can be worse. And it can go in both directions, as we've seen horribly with the Ahmaud Arbery murder in Georgia. Both directions. But this is what you want to do. You want to pit races against one another. Oppressor, victim. Justified in looting, rioting, engaging in violence, not justified. And you will have different people make different, offer different rationales solely based on who is doing the rioting or who is breaking the law more generally rather than what they're doing, the actual behavior. That's the way you want to play it. Because that's the way it is being played. Nobody will say that's the way they want to play it. That is the way it is being played. Bob in Waukegan.
Yeah, everybody should get Ann Coulter's 2012 book called Mugged. I'll read you four of the table of contents things here. It says, innocent until proven white, guilty until proven black, Obama, the race demagogue, chapter 15, and chapter 17, white guilt kills. I'm about halfway through with it, and it talks about if you're white, you get screwed. If you're black, you get a pass. So yeah. That's pretty much the media in America today, and you know, all the former liberals who are now leftist.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah, I would recommend, if you're going to read a book on the topic, Ann Coulter's Polemics would not be at the top of my list, but White Guilt by Shelby Steele would be. If you want to understand it, if you want to understand what the left is doing, not just have somebody describe what's happening. If you want to understand it going back to the 60s and taking it to, well, the publication of White Guilt, which was 20 years ago, read Shelby Steele's White Guilt. That's the seminal work on the topic. And his work since, frankly. Dave, Downers Grove.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I use this example a lot of how the press is trying to create a race vision. But do you remember when the old white guy was drunk and yelling at the freaking girl with the T-shirt? That went on for months as a hate crime. I think he was charged with a hate crime. But at the same time, there was a black woman in the news once for beating a 90-year-old Mexican critically and putting him in the hospital, and that was only aired once. And it was never, I don't think she was ever charged with a hate crime.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Dave. Well, that's, I mean, so this is...
It's a Forest Preserve police this is
the problem generally. I mean, it's all the Stop Asian Hate. Remember the Stop Asian Hate business last year? And what do we find about these attacks on people who are Asian in New York City just because they were Asian? Most of the attacks in terms of people who are actually caught for committing these acts of violence were black.
Right.
And then 85%. What happened to Stop Asian Hate?
It went away.
Right.
Because it made the black community look bad. So they dropped it.
And it doesn't make the black community look bad. It's just the idea but that's sort of the poison that has infected the minds of the group thinking identitarians. I mean, a black guy commits a crime that reflects on every other black guy. No, it doesn't. But it is when you say everybody is just their race. You just, you know, group people accordingly. And say, well, I don't do that. I judge people based on their character. I judge people based on what they do. That's what people say. Because we know what's right. That is not where we are. That is not what's actually happening. I mean, how many grade schools need to be segregated by race, a la the one in Atlanta, where a black mom is suing over it, before what people are saying versus what they are doing, the contradiction becomes clear to people. Well, that's not how I would do it. That's not who I am. That's not how we should do it. Well, that's the way people are doing it, institutionally. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, I'd like for all school board members to be replaced with only people who have children, because they're more likely to know what's not okay to teach children.
I completely disagree. Thanks for the call, Terry. And it's not just because I don't have children.
Well, you have hypothetical.
Yeah, I have fictional children.
Very fictional, yeah.
But,
how are they doing, by the way? We haven't talked about
very, very well.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. They didn't fall behind in COVID. We stayed on top of things.
Okay, good.
This is the folly of you have to have experienced something to comment on it or address it. No, you don't.
Yeah, no, you don't.
I mean, in point of fact, like the positions I have on what should be done in K through 12 education are positions shared by lots of parents and opposed by other parents. So, again, your life experience is interesting. It can be informative. It can also be misleading. The quality of what you're advocating for should be measured based on the evidence and the outcomes, not just your personal background. I mean, Terry, do you know school board members who have behaved in an absolutely abhorrent manner over the last 2 years who have kids? Of course you do.
Well, the one that was most abhorrent was from Glenbrook North, Taub.
Yeah.
The guy that was swinging. But he doesn't have kids. He's got grandkids that are about to come up in the system.
Well, whatever. The guy who's obsessed with other people's balls.
Right,
no,
the balls guy. Yeah, balls guy.
Right, so he's got kids, mm-hmm. And he's a goon. So what is that? No. Your experience can be helpful. It can also be misleading. Mark in Ashburn.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing? To show you where, just a real quick story on where we are today with race. A few weeks ago, I was walking into a store early in the morning, and a lady was walking out, and she points at the ground, and she goes, "Be careful. There's black ice right there." And I swear, this is a true story. And I said, "Oh, be careful with that term," joking around with her. She paused for a minute, looked very reflectively, and goes, "Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I got to be more careful." And I walked into the store shaking my head, thinking, you have to be kidding me. This couldn't have been serious. She was. She was dead serious. Mm-hmm. How pathetic is that? Black ice is now racist. Pete Buttigieg, eat your heart out. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mark. Mike and Hammond.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys. Yeah, we had an example of it just last year. We had the Kyle Rittenhouse, who at every turn it was a white guy, and every half the nation thought he was killing black people. And then you had the black guy driving the car into the Waukesha parade, and they blamed it on the car. The mainstream media blamed it on the car. That's it.
Right. Thank you, comic. Right. The car ran into people,
right.
Not the driver.
That?
Uh-huh. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Trump rallied the faithful in Florence, South Carolina over the weekend, and it was a big turnout.
Oh, yeah.
No question about that. And he had this to say about critics of his personality when it came to the world stage.
The fake news said my personality would get us into a war. I'm telling you, that guy's going to get us into a war. Oh, but actually, my personality is what kept us out of war. I was the only president in nearly four decades who did not get America into any new conflicts. Instead, I brought our troops and our wonderful children back home. I brought them back home where they belong.
He went on to say Russia, meaning Putin, knew better than to tangle with Trump.
I speak for everyone here tonight when I say we are praying for the proud people of Ukraine. They are going through hell. They are fighters, and God bless them all. Make no mistake, however, that Russia would not have dared to annex one inch of territory if I was in the White House. In fact, they never did it when I was there. A lot of people ask the question, how come they never did it when Trump was president? And China, he said they knew better. It is true. As the only president of the 21st century on whose watch Russia did not invade another country and neither did anyone else, they knew. Under our administration, we had peace through strength. That's what it was. Our country was safe and the world was calm because America was strong.
That's an argument you'll be hearing Trump make for the rest of this campaign cycle and maybe the next one as well. Now, on the other side, President Biden, the two presidents here, President Biden offered this on the prospect of Russia using chemical weapons, which is sort of the next stage of Putin aggression that is being debated at present in terms of what will the response be if he does it, as the Russians are telegraphing it by suggesting that Ukraine will use chemical weapons. That's a tell that Putin may be ready to use chemical weapons and make this even more ghastly than it already is. Here's what Biden had to say about that.
I'm not going to speak about the intelligence, but Russia would pay a severe price if they use chemical
weapons. Okay, severe price. Yeah. What does that mean? I'm not sure, because on Friday in Pennsylvania, he had this to say about staving off World War III.
And we will not, although we will not fight the Third World War in Ukraine. Putin's war against Ukraine will never be a victory. Democrats are rising to meet the moment, rallying the world on the side of peace and security. We're showing the strength and we'll never falter. But look, the idea that we're going to send in offensive equipment and have planes and tanks and trains going in with American pilots and American crews, just understand, and don't kid yourself, no matter what you all say, that's called World War III, okay? Let's get it straight here, guys. That old expression, don't kid a kidder.
Stop.
With that old expression, don't kid a kidder, I don't know what that means.
Right.
Maybe
this guy's in charge.
Maybe we can get some help in terms of ciphering the president, the current one, from our friend Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, don't kid a kidder. That would be World War III if we escalated to offensive weapons. But there will be severe consequences if Russia uses chemical weapons. Can you help us square that circle?
I'd like to say it's amateur art at the White House, but I don't want to insult amateurs all over the world. Look, there's two facets to diplomacy, which is not about, everybody thinks diplomacy is about negotiating. It's not. Diplomacy is about what you say to your opponent or your adversary or your friend to influence their behavior. And there's two sides to that. There's the public side, and then there's the private side, which we never see, which is sometimes done through back channels, through third-party countries. Sometimes it's done in secret negotiations, like when Kissinger was negotiating with China about recognition. You go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the two different things that were said in public and the different things that were said in private.
in private, if you want to say to the Russians in private, look, you guys realize you touch 1 inch of NATO territory and it's Katie bar the door. But short of that, you know, we're going to do everything we can to support the Ukrainians, but we're not going to be a party to this conflict. That's fine, because you're actually putting a red line out that they probably would accept as meaningful because it's done in private. In public, you don't say nonsense that actually makes you look weaker. That's because that actually encourages your opponent to be more aggressive. And if anybody should have learned anything in dealing with the Russians, when you give the Russians a unilateral concession for nothing, the Russians see that as weakness, and they seek to take advantage of you. Conversely, when you show strength and you warn the Russians, or you put a red line up and you demonstrate the willingness to enforce that, then the Russians take you seriously. So everything that Biden said was nonsense. And conversely, if you look at, you know, Trump, yeah, okay, people didn't like the orange hair and the tweeting and whatever, but what they did not see, and if you talk to people who actually were in the White House, what Trump told the Russians in private scared the hell out of the Russians, and that's why they stopped. And the reality is when people say, well, who could have deterred this? Because now we know that Putin made his actually decision in January to invade. The reality is if 9 months ago when this had started, we did everything that we are doing today. We front-loaded all the support and everything to the Ukrainians, and we sanctioned the heck out of these guys. If we'd done all that at the front end, Putin would have been deterred.
So what are we going to do, and what is the plan if chemical warfare is used, if there's a nuclear weapon that is used, and if Russia strikes Poland?
Well, those are three very different things. Look, I think if Russia strikes Poland, that you have attacked a NATO country, and that Poland would turn to the rest of NATO and say, hey. And then what I suspect would happen is what I would call a proportional response, right? So depending upon what the Russians did, the NATO response to that would be proportional. So they wouldn't escalate to starting World War III. My guess is if they would attack the forces that attacked the Polish thing. So if that was an Air Force thing, it might take out a base, or it may take out a unit. So that's called proportionality. That's my guess of what would happen if they actually attacked NATO territory. And if they escalated beyond that, then I think NATO would respond beyond that. I think if they use chemical or nuclear weapons inside of Ukraine, there will obviously be an escalated humanitarian effort. There's going to be a lot of fear. Your stock portfolio is going to be really bad. But I do think Russia will be further isolated and for a longer period of time. And this will put a lot of strain on China, and it'll ripple across a whole bunch of things. But will NATO take military action against Russia because they use weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine? And my answer would probably not.
Stavridis, the former NATO Supreme Commander, Admiral James Stavridis, said over the weekend, if chemical weapons are used, then NATO should train Ukrainian pilots and give Ukraine planes to enforce their own no-fly zone.
Well, that's a stupid statement. And let me tell you why it's stupid. Because we can provide any kind of legitimate aid to Ukraine that we want. And there's no constraint on that. And the stupidity of saying, well, if they get more aggressive, you know, then we'll actually do something. That's just stupid. That's what got us into this war to begin with, because we are self-deterring. There is no limit to the assistance that we can provide Ukraine to defend itself. And trying to warn people and say, well, if you start blowing stuff up, we'll help them more. That's just nonsense, mm-hmm. right? So if you're going to help Ukraine, give them the resources that they need so they can defend themselves. But don't sit back there and repeat the stupidity of saying, well, we can do more, you know, if you get more aggressive. I mean, we were all kids in the schoolyard. Does anybody ever remember one case where somebody went to a bully and said, if you smack me in the face one more time, I'm going to tell the teacher? And that worked.
How did you interpret this op-ed from the head of a Beijing-based NGO in the New York Times over the weekend? It's time to give Russia an off-ramp. China can help. He writes, achieving a multilateral resolution to the crisis in Ukraine will be a difficult and risky challenge, but there's no country better placed to do so than China. Is that an indication that China wants this over?
Well, yeah, it is, but it's also the very Chinese way of essentially instigating the whole thing, pushing the Russians over the cliff, giving them all the back, and then saying, "Oh yeah, and we're the ones that can negotiate an end to this."
But does this indicate that they've tired of Putin's foray into Ukraine? They're signaling to him, knock it off or get it done or end this one way or the other.
Yeah, well, they have very little capacity to actually do that. And I doubt that they seriously think that Putin's going to take that advantage. I think what they say is, look, what do we have to lose here? On the one hand, if Putin keeps fighting, big deal. If he stops, we could take credit for it and look like the good guys here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's typical Chinese obfuscation, right? It's pretending to be the good guy when they're clearly not the good guy here. And they are clearly not a neutral party. And the notion of the notion of the Chinese negotiating an end of this war is like you going through the Russians to negotiate the Iran deal in the middle of a war with Russia.
Which we're doing. On the other side of, well, it's sort of the same side of the ledger, actually, but from a different angle, a report by Axios that Israel PM Naftali Bennett has told Zelensky he needs to, they're reporting he needs to surrender, whatever surrender looks like, but essentially that Naftali Bennett is trying to broker this thing to be over, too, as Israel has tried to sort of middle the two.
I don't know if that's true, because on the one hand, it sounds very non-Israeli. Like, could you imagine the Israelis in the Six-Day War, at which everybody did say, hey, you guys just need to pack it up, call it a day. So it doesn't actually something like an Israeli leader would say. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what they said. I mean, is it advice that Ukraine is likely to take? The answer is no. The problem
go ahead,
is when you try to negotiate with the Russians from a position of weakness, you're going to get absolutely slammed into the dirt. So the best the Ukrainians can do is fight on as hard as they can and hope that they can have some military victory on the battlefield, which actually forces the Russians to come to terms. That's the only option they have other than losing everything in their country. Because while they're losing, there is zero chance that they're going to get a cut a deal with the Russians that allows them to keep anything other than maybe the flag, and 5 inches of Ukrainian territory.
But is this opening up the Middle East and destabilizing the Middle East in a way that has Israel concerned? For example, Iran claiming a missile barrage near the U.S. consulate in Iraq over the weekend.
Yeah, I think that the Russians have very limited influence and capability to move in the Middle East beyond Syria, and I think everybody knows that. So I don't think that. I think what's terrifying to the Middle East is the opening of Iran and unleashing of Iran on them. And I don't think in the end the Russians can really help the Israelis that much against the Iranians. I think that's a pipe dream. If that's if they think that's the only card they have left, then things are, the situation in the region is really, really desperate. But what's significantly destabilizing the region is the same thing that destabilized Europe and put Tehran at risk. It's a White House which is encouraging aggressive people to be more aggressive.
Well, yeah. I mean, Iran, accidentally bombed our consulate in Iraq, but it's okay because the Biden administration tells us the consulate wasn't the target of the attack. Doesn't that look weak?
This is complete nonsense. A formal body of the Iranian government fires missiles into the sovereign territory of another country, and we say, well, we're indifferent to that because didn't actually kill any Americans.
Really? Ridiculous.
That's your metric of responsible behavior? And this is the problem with this administration, which is they want to find every excuse they can find to do nothing about a problem. And, so they talk about norm setting and responsible behavior and values and all this stuff, but they duck their head in the sand if it means that they have to do something. They will accept any embarrassment or aggression or, stepping over the line as long as they can get away with doing nothing. And then when it's done, they poke their heads out and say, we are the people that stand for freedom and democracy and responsibility and liberty and international norms. It's nonsense.
What did you make of the White House briefing TikTok influencers with sort of the administration's narrative, if you will, on policy with respect to this war in Ukraine?
Ended up being an SNL skit.
I'm sort of mixed opinion on this because on the one hand, okay, that's fine. I mean, you want to get the word out and what's true and have people generate as much understanding as they're capable of about Russian aggression, this invasion, what Putin is doing, what the Ukrainians are doing and trying to fight for their homeland and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, as Putin is shutting down Facebook in Russia and deplatforming antagonistic media, you know, we have big tech companies in this country and in the West and Europe, too, doing the same thing to Russian outlets. So I just what your take on sort of the war over communications?
Well, look, I have real issues with talking to TikTok influencers since TikTok is essentially has a backdoor into China, and it's used to vacuum up information on Americans and influence Americans all over the country. So of all the platforms they could have chosen to go to me, it's irresponsible. I mean, I think we were on the right track when we were insisting that China divest itself of TikTok if TikTok was going to be allowed to operate in the United States. So in that respect, I think it's just utterly tone deaf and stupid. I mean, I think the problem for this administration is they're obviously pandering to progressives in America. I doubt there's one TikTok influencer that they talk to that is remotely in the center, let alone right of center. And so if you're trying to lead America, you should be doing things that lead America. And, you know, so it wasn't the conservative leadership and the White House getting together to talk to these people. It was the White House. So it's the left essentially trying to talk to the left. That's not presidential leadership in time of crisis.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano. He is the Vice President of the Catherine Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. The book, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks as always.
Yeah, and today, obviously over-caffeinated, or maybe it's just you guys.
Yeah, no, I can understand the many sources of frustration. I think our listeners can, too. Appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Come join the murder. Come fly with Black. Well, he'll give you freedom from the human trap. Come join the murder. Soar on my wings. You'll touch the hand of God, and he'll make you king. He'll make you king.
Dan and Amy, come join the murder, the theme song of Big Blue City America, unfortunately. A new study on 2021 homicide trends released by the Council on Criminal Justice found an additional 5% rise in homicides on the heels of a 30% increase in 2020. In nearly two dozen major American cities, L.A., Louisville, D.C. saw homicides increase by more than 10%. Chicago is up 7%, 800 total, plus 800 plus. We've got more than 100 murders so far this year. We're only in mid-March, more than 500 shot, and we're not to the warm weather months yet, of course. Right. Correspondingly, a good piece from Rav Arora over at City Journal, Manhattan Institute's work product. Last year, police retirements were up 50%. Resignations were up 18% across 200 police departments nationwide. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, one of the leading advocates of defund the police, now saying, quote, "There is such a thing as too few officers. I can objectively say we are critically short-staffed." Well, gee, I wonder why that is, Ted. In Philadelphia, which last year suffered more homicides than in 2014 and 2015 combined, the police department is short about 300 officers. The director of the Police Executive Research Forum, Chuck Wexler, says of the national staffing shortage, quote, "It is an evolving crisis," unquote. And we know that Chicago is part of that evolving crisis in terms of police staffing. And what is the response from the powers that be in the city, starting with Triple Threat, to fire police officers who don't get vaccinated? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by FOP President John Cantanzara. John, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So give us a state of play between FOP and the mayor when it comes to the officers who are facing termination.
Well, it's a head scratcher to say the least. What passes for logic these days. But Mayor Putin seems determined to implode this city any way, shape, or form she possibly can. But I know she put out a statement that public safety will not be affected. And all they're going to do is the same thing they did when it came to the portal and putting your information in the portal starting in October. They're going to call in groups of officers anywhere from 30 to 75 or 80 a day and basically tell them, our records say you don't have the vaccine. Is that correct or is that not? If it's not, go home. If you're not getting vaccinated, you are no longer in paid status. And come back when you want to get the vaccine, basically, is what's going to happen. As opposed to, and again, this has been an issue from the previous time they did this, officers will be in no-pay status a lot longer than the end of the rainbow when the last person goes through this process. It is not fair whatsoever. If everybody is in violation of the policy today, then everybody should be put in no-pay status at the same time if you are really hell-bent on pushing forward your agenda.
Well, but I mean, she should obviously she should remove the employee vaccine mandate. American Airlines did. United Airlines did. But I don't think she will because her ego won't allow you police officers to have a win.
Well, I called her Bear Putin for a reason. She literally will implode the world and just be in charge of ashes as long as she wins. That's all that matters. You know, you won't even have to wear a mask on a plane in another week. What are we doing here?
I don't know about the Mayor Putin thing, but but with respect to the number of officers that she's going to do on a rolling basis, as you were describing, what's the total number we're talking about?
So March 1st, it was 2809 was the number we got from the city. Since then, it has only gone down about 36 officers, I believe, have gotten vaccinated since then. So
nearly 3,000 officers under her policy could be terminated, and she's just going to do a 30 to 75 at a time rolling no pay status.
Correct, until she gets forced compliance, and that's all this has ever been about, was forced compliance, no matter what. And their thought is the more pain they can inflict on the unvaccinated, the more likely they are to submit by slow rolling it.
But broils my blood is the fact that she has three members in her inner circle, work for the city, and they don't have to get vaccinated for medical reasons or religious reasons. But they can keep their jobs, but police officers can't. Same with CPS. She made different rules up for different unions. I mean, is there still a testing option for you guys of these 2,700 police officers that aren't vaccinated?
So if they have a vaccine exemption, yes, they have to get tested. Otherwise, there is no other testing option. The testing is only for the people who have the exemption. The exemptions were issues from the beginning, and we brought it up in arbitration, in court filings. I believe there's going to be another kind of not union attempt because the Cook County court system is so corrupt. There is an attorney who will be filing on behalf of many city workers about the policy itself. And we decided that we had been in conversations with this attorney, and everybody knows probably who I'm talking about. But what we said was we didn't want to give the courts the ability to say that they are your bargaining agent, not him. So they're dismissing it on the behalf of the lodge being involved. So we're encouraging officers. I know he's got a bunch of firemen involved in this and some other city workers to challenge the policy. Who wrote it? Who has the authority to enact it? And kind of go from it from a different angle.
What is the attrition rate right now with police between retirements and resignations? You heard some of the numbers in across the nation, the aggregate numbers. Because, I mean, we've seen other communities from around the country are purposely recruiting officers in big cities with vax mandates like in Chicago. And I just wonder what's happening with respect to retirements and resignations, how short-staffed is CPD going to be, you know, over the summer, for example?
Well, we are already short-staffed. I mean, to say we're over 1,000 understaffed, and don't forget, there was a budget passed that cut 640 jobs out of the CPD payroll a year and a half ago. Now, that skewed the numbers, too, because they were unfilled jobs, so let's just cut them. But that was still the original number that we're working off of that now doesn't even count. So there's no doubt in my mind, if they didn't gerrymander the numbers like they do congressional and Senate districts in this state, you would have at least probably a number of 1,500 to 2,000 less officers than we did 3 years ago.
So
there's no way around it.
So then what are we looking at this year? I mean, in your estimation, are we looking at another 800 murders and 4,000 shootings in 2022 like we saw last year?
Worse. No, there's no way around it. Worse. Bloodier. No doubt. And the politicians have stood by. I was literally at a political function telling a room of probably 300 plus Chicago people that they need to get involved. This was about 10 days ago. Before this happened, 2,800 plus officers could be subjected to no pay. We don't need less officers. We need more on the street. And the sad reality is the politicians in that room, including two sitting aldermen, did not care what I said. They didn't even repeat what the calls for when I got to the microphone. It's like this doesn't even exist. I
applaud. Say names. Names. Who? What aldermen?
Gil Villegas and Ariel Laboris, who used to be the chairman of public safety and actually has a daughter on the job. And literally, the first thing I said to him when I walked in the room was, what are you guys doing? Nobody is stopping this from happening. Yeah, I know. It's terrible. Hey, by the way, there's a function coming up next week. Totally blows off and changes the subject. Like, I didn't even say what I just said to him. And then got the microphone and talks about himself. Same thing with Villegas. He talks about how I'm running for Congress. Doesn't even care about any of this. It's disgusting what passes for leadership in this city.
Speaking of leadership within the police department, I wanted to get your latest take on this Yolanda Talley matter. I mean, she's the head of internal affairs. Her car taken by her niece. She's given a known heroin dealer a ride, and he's throwing bags of heroin out the window. Okay, they get caught and so on and so forth. And yet none of the protocols in terms of a drug-related arrest were followed in the Yolanda Talley case, and Lightfoot just passes this off as, anybody who's critical of Yolanda Talley is critical because she's a black female or something like this.
Well, of course that's the case. And full disclosure, I actually sat in the same classroom with Yolanda Talley in the academy back in January of 95. And I've certainly lately had some run-ins with Yolanda Talley, who, when we had another police suicide last year, had thrown me off the crime scene as the president of the union servicing my members because that poor soul had mentioned the mayor in his suicide note. And when they realized that that was in the note, whoever she was talking to on the phone decided that I needed to be kicked off the scene before I found out about it, not knowing I already did know about it. But that's a whole other side note. The Yolanda Talley incident with this car, the procedures were followed. You know, they took the car, they took the subject into custody, they all brought it to Holman Square. When it got to Holman Square, that's when things went sideways. And that's because phone calls started being made and people above the officers making the arrest started getting involved on what do we do now.
Yeah, but you don't normally put the officers, you don't take the officers off the street. Why did they do that? Because Superintendent Brown, I was with him. Dan, you were off that day, and I was with, and he said, we have to examine the behavior of the officers. And I said, well, you're making it sound like they didn't follow protocol. And he said, well, you just have to wait and see.
Well,
so now they're pinning
I know
it on
for
them.
Fact, right. And the strange here, somebody needs to answer these questions. And in reality, when they took it into Holman Square, they brought the car back and delivered it back to the scene. Even if cars are returned, they are not delivered. Almost like with a car wash and a vacuum, here's your car back. Literally come and get your car and give it back to the person. Now, that's one. Number two, it was turned over to the person who is not the owner. Another thing, you don't do that. You give it back to the registered owner, not the person that ended up driving the car, who, by the way, wasn't even driving legally. So yeah, that'd be a third reason you wouldn't return it back to her to begin with, because she didn't have a valid license. That all happened because there was a meeting in Holman Square by the sergeant, the lieutenant, and the commander of that unit, who had a powwow and decided that this was what we were going to do and give the car back to her. Because, and that goes right up to Ernie Cato. Rob Rubio, I was told, was in the meeting too, who was another person I went to the academy with too. So it's sad that these people have literally decided to carry the water no matter what. And I'm not saying to see if this one even goes up to Yolanda Talley. I'm sure at some point she was notified what was going on. But this goes at least all the way up to Cato, who made the decision that this was all going to go away.
And who is he?
He is the chief of counterterrorism.
So who investigates the investigators? Who investigates internal affairs if the officers are going to be assigned desk duty until the investigation is complete? Wouldn't it necessarily include an investigation of Yolanda Talley, since it's her car involved in the crime?
Well, correct. And again, this has been a problem with CPD forever. And I've been talking about the lack of accountability, and nobody does anything about the brass. They get away with whatever they do. And it, just on face value, she should have been removed from her post, if even temporarily, until this investigation is complete, because her unit is conducting the investigation. This makes no sense to anybody except CPD and the mayor.
I mean, so even if you're a victim of a carjacking, you have to go to the pound and get your car back to the tune of $150.
Yeah, I mean, you have to go get it. And that's right, if you have to show proof of registration that the car belongs to you. You have to show proof of insurance.
I've been towed enough.
Those are not decisions that.
Right. Yeah,
and of course the patrol officers are thrown under the bus time and time again, and they're going to use them as the scapegoat.
So as if this isn't obvious, what this does to morale, you're going to have patrol officers even more demoralized and perhaps on their heels than they have been previously, with more sort of at least the perception that there are different rules for different people within the department. I don't know how that that produces camaraderie and sort of I got your back culture, because the brass clearly doesn't.
They certainly do not. All they care about is themselves. And it was no more evident than in this whole COVID policy, when not one single exempt rank member from the police department stood up and said, this policy is stupid, it's unsustainable, and it's dangerous. None of them. They all just carried the water and did what they were supposed to do, like good little soldiers, and to hell with the lower ranks who after. Man, listen, they're trying to force officers out the door over a COVID policy, but yet cancel days off for everybody in specialized units over the weekend for St. Patrick's Day parades. So on one hand, you're saying, we know we don't have enough officers for work. We're going to keep canceling days off every weekend, apparently, but we're going to keep forcing people out the door, too, for noncompliance. It is just such an upside-down world of thinking.
And another year of carnage, it seems, as you suggested. He is John Canzara, FOP president.
And Dan,
yes.
I will point this out, Dan, because I know this is near and dear to your heart. The other reality I kept talking about was not only the public safety of more blood in the street and safety for the officers, but the fact that the less officers that are on the street means they're retiring, and we already have a pension fund that's in a crisis,
yeah.
And we're going to add more checks going out the door than people paying in, which goes on the taxpayers' responsibility because it is a constitutionally protected promise, and that's not changing. So there is a reason why people should be concerned.
That is another storm that is not too far off in the distance. There's no question about it. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a good morning.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know you're in a bad way when you can barely convince your own party that things are going well. That was the case when Reparation H, the Vice President, Kamala Harris, came to address the general session of the DNC this weekend and said this. Listen to the reaction.
I know, and I believe we know, when we show what we have accomplished just in a year.
What, oh, my God.
And when we show it is because the American people voted, I believe we will meet the moment again. But that is our task. Our task is to show people that in many ways they got what they ordered. Right? They said this is what they wanted.
The sound of two hands clapping.
Wow, that's pretty bad, Dan.
They got what they ordered. They ordered high inflation. Well, no, I know. I know. It's not Joe Biden's fault. He said so.
Right. As you provide this support to Ukraine, we're going to continue to stand together with our allies in Europe and send unmistakable message that we will defend every inch of NATO territory, every single inch, with a united, galvanized NATO. One movement. That's why I moved over 12,000 American forces along the borders with Russia, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Romania, etc. Because they move once. Granted, if we respond, it is World War III, but we have a sacred obligation on NATO territory, a sacred obligation, Article 5. And we will not, although we will not, fight the Third World War in Ukraine.
No, that was a different clip. But he was complaining about Americans blaming him for inflation when, of course, it's a Putin price hike. Nancy Pelosi also borrowing a page from Joe Biden in Joe Obama's first term, you recall, with the bailouts following the 2008 recession. Joe Biden famously said, we need to keep spending to prevent from going bankrupt. Nancy Pelosi said, we need to keep spending to keep inflation down.
So when we're having this discussion, it's important to dispel some of those who say, well, it's the government spending. No, it isn't. The government spending is doing the exact reverse, reducing the national debt. It is not inflationary. A. B, we don't want to reduce the increase in jobs, which we're very proud of, this president breaking records.
Yeah, so $12, $13 trillion of funny money is non-inflationary. It's reducing the debt, you see. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend John Tammany. He is a editor at RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of When Politicians Panicked, of course, about COVID. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So government spending is non-inflationary.
Well, it's not. I mean, I hate to say it, it's not. A devaluation of the currency is what is inflation. Government, there's this view that government spending doubles up on demand in the economy. No, governments can only spend what they've taken from us first. And so even demand can't drive prices up. Destruction of the currency can, and we've seen that. It happened most notably under George W. Bush in the 2000s, but it's happening again now. If you look at gold, which is just an objective measure of the dollar's value, it's over $2,000. And so we're seeing a devaluation of the dollar under Biden. That's the inflation. And I think everyone needs to get their story straight.
And the printing press, that has nothing to do with driving inflation?
Well, I reject
devaluing the currency and thus driving inflation. Money supply doesn't matter.
I think people vastly overstate that. What's the fifth most supplied currency in the world? It's the Swiss franc. They've got a population of what, 8 million. Are they devaluing their currency? Their supply is enormous. No, because it's much demanded around the world.
Well, right. You know, don't we have too many dollars chasing too few goods at this point?
No, I don't think so. In Mexico, do you think there's lots of pesos going around? You think in North Korea there's lots of won going around? The currency of choice in North Korea is the dollar. I mean, we can get into the weeds on this, but the simple truth is Devaluation is a policy choice. It happened under Jimmy Carter. It did not happen under Ronald Reagan. It did not happen under Bill Clinton. It's no surprise that Reagan and Clinton oversaw booming economies and stock markets. It happened substantially under George W. Bush. Do you think that oil just sextupled under Bush just by coincidence? Or do you think that that was his policy to devalue the dollar? Do you think that the dollar fell against the euro, yen, yuan, every major currency during Bush? Was that not inflation? My point here is I don't want to get an argument, but I see consistency in this. I just wish for once a right who's suddenly all over Biden, and Biden's a complete clown. Find me the pieces by me that defend him. But a much more substantial devaluation of the dollar occurred under Bush, and I don't remember most conservatives talking about the inflation then.
Well, I mean, you did have conservatives talking about government spending and Fed policy. I mean, government spending in terms of creating new entitlements like Medicare Part D. I remember talking about that and being opposed to it. And the profligate spending under most presidencies, with few exceptions over the last, 125 years. But I mean, the idea that that Fed policy, asset purchases and printing money, everybody gets a payoff, is not connected to devaluing the currency and driving inflation. I'm having a hard time understanding.
Well, that's fine, but that's not what's happening. The Fed is borrowing money from banks. That's where it's getting the money to make these asset purchases. And if you think that I support this stuff, feel free to look through books I've written about the Fed and look through op-eds. If you can find someone who's been more critical of the Fed over the years than me, I want to meet this person. But that's not the cause of a devalued dollar. The devalued dollar is policy, and it's a policy choice. Look, we had deficits under Ronald Reagan, yet the dollar was rising in value. To pretend that that's what the cause is just a mistake, cause and effect. Reagan was for a strong dollar. Bill Clinton was for a strong dollar.
So be specific then about the policy cause of the of inflation that's trending towards double digits.
Well, the policy cause, I think, is fairly obvious. 2 years ago, they shut down major parts of the global economy.
And right.
You think that you can just turn that back on and expect the global... I know you're familiar with iPencil. Even something as basic as the pencil is the result of remarkable global cooperation. So you destroy supply chains developed by billions of workers engaged in trillions of different transactions over decades, and then expect that miracle, the miracle that resulted in remarkably low prices, to come back online, is fanciful on a level that's hard to put a number, or it's just staggering.
Well, I agree with that.
I know, but it staggers me that conservatives would say, well, this is inflation. No, command and control was imposed on the economy, and dare I say it, who was in office at the time? And
I agree.
I beg you to find someone. You've been having me on for years. I am not a Democrat, listeners. I am the biggest critic of government I think you'll find out there. And so we had global lockdowns. Is it any surprise that prices are higher today? Now,
well,
demerits of Biden, I'll give them to you.
But this
is not inflation.
This
is command and control that results in higher prices. You shut down an economy, you're going to limit the ability of the people to produce at levels that are very low in terms of prices.
I agree with that. I agree with that. This all begins with shutting down a $20 trillion economy and the hubris of thinking you flip a switch and then everything goes back to where it was previously, like magic. I completely agree with that. But then you also have to address flooding the zone with $10 to $12 trillion of funny money, so that the economy was the government printing money and distributing it.
Well, but again, I think you overstate the printing money aspect of it, but yes, government did, after destroying an economy or parts of it, Under Republicans, President Trump signed a $2.9 trillion spending bill, which was the ultimate non sequitur. Okay, we've wrecked you, so we're going to throw money at you, when the only answer was to stop wrecking you in the first place. And so more of my frustration with this is, hey, you want to talk about the oil price? Let's talk about the oil price. Yeah, why was it $10 a barrel under Reagan and Clinton? Well, guess what? They had good dollar policy. And dollar policy comes from Treasury. There's this myth that the Fed controls the value of the dollar. It does not. It never has. I can cite chapter and verse to you going back through history to show you the devaluations. They were the consequence of Treasury and the president, not what the Fed did. But if we want to talk about the oil price, yeah, when Bush got into office, it was $25 a barrel. At one point during his presidency, it was $150. The inflation that we're talking about, the devaluation of the dollar, has been a 21st century thing. It's not something that some nobody, inconsequential person like Biden cooked up within a year in the White House.
No, but it is.
There's so much to criticize Biden about, but let's be real about where these high prices came from.
So what is your response to the modern monetary theorists that span administrations that believe in that there is no downside to the Fed printing money?
Well, I think it's absurd, but the Fed is just an arm of government. You think that quote, money printing wouldn't occur without the Fed? That's just the Fed is just an outsourced version of what Congress would be doing anyway. And so we can talk about printing money. I think you once again overstate the cause and again what's happened. Yeah, but modern monetary theory is as old as mankind. And it is ridiculous as it gets. The idea that you can print wealth defies basic common sense. Wealth is created. It cannot be printed. And so, of course, it's ridiculous. My only dispute here is I think we have to look at why prices are much higher today. And I think a lot of this is rooted in what happened long before Biden got into office. You can't shut down a global economy and expect prices to remain low.
Well, understood, although, of course, we know that this administration from top to bottom is full of cheerleaders for the shutdown of the economy, too. So whether it predated him and also includes him or not, this is the policy choice they advocated for. Let's talk specifically about energy. I want to get your reaction to this response from Jackie Daly, who's an attorney in the energy sector, and she's at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. She was also a staff attorney for a couple of congressional committees. This is in response to the energy pronouncements from Mayor Pete and Kamala last week, where they're imagining, electric buses and trains and so forth. Listen to Jackie Daly.
We need to use what we have right now in place already for the immediate crisis. Does he understand there's a war going on that could quickly explode into something much bigger? Does he understand
more ways than one?
We don't have time for this. Second, he clearly doesn't understand that electric vehicles are made from oil. Every piece of them are made from oil. The fiberglass, the paint, the battery, everything is made from oil. Moreover, I mean, the battery components themselves are made of rare earth elements, the supply chain of which is controlled by China. He's giving more supply chain control to China, and the Germans are doing the same. Right now, they're doubling down in the middle of this war, like, oh, this is a great time to build more solar and more electric vehicles. No, because they're like, we control our solar. Russia controls the natural gas. They have the gas. We control the solar. No, you don't. China controls the solar and the electric vehicles. And by the way, Germany's sitting on top of a sea of natural gas that they refuse to frack because the Green Movement succeeded in getting them to commit suicide and become totally dependent on the Russians.
And that's what's happening here, too.
Yeah, which is disgusting.
John?
She's not as confused as Buttigieg and all them are. But look, I'll take you back to it's an interview with George W. Bush. He said, when I first met Putin, he was desperate. Well, guess what? Yeah, with oil at $25 a barrel, Putin was desperate, and his country needed help. Who bailed him out? The United States. We devalued the dollar, and oil went up over six times during Bush's presidency. I can come on here and tell you what you want to hear, that we've got to drill, baby, drill, But there's simply no basis for that. Under Reagan and Clinton, Reagan is heroic as it gets, and he's my favorite president. Guess what? There's no drilling in the United States. Why? Not because of the Greens, but because at $10, $20 a barrel, the economics of extracting oil in the United States made no sense. So the industry largely didn't exist. Now, in that realm, and under Clinton, too, with a strong dollar, the Russians weren't a threat to do anything because oil was inexpensive. And so we can talk about drilling, but the reality is, and Harold Hamm will tell you this, read my books and you'll see the quotes from him, it doesn't make sense to extract oil, to frack it at prices below $60 or $50 a barrel. There's a reason the frackers are dormant right now. No one will finance their activity. And why will they not? Because oil has to be very expensive for fracking to make economic sense. So we can talk about drill, baby, drill, and all this jingoistic stuff that pleases everyone, says, oh, aren't we great, and aren't the Greens stupid? Well, of course the Greens are complete idiots. But if you actually want to do something about the price of a barrel of oil, we've got to change dollar policy. It's been horrendous under Republicans and Democrats for the last 20 years. And so, sorry, that's what I will tell you.
So when Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy says that we could supply 160,000 barrels of oil per day if you greenlighted the Willow Project in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, you say you're missing the point, that's not a supply issue?
Well, you think 160,000 barrels would be a drop in the bucket? You think that would change what is a global price? There's this myth out there that there's a U.S. price for oil and a France price. No, it's a global price. It would be utterly meaningless. Let's have it. I am for freedom to drill wherever it makes economic sense. But I'm just making the point that how funny it is that when the U.S. was not even a player in oil, oil was cheapest. Well, there's a reason for that. Under Reagan and Clinton, dollar policy was very sound. Remember the constant refrain from Clinton's Treasury Secretary, strong dollars in the interest, in the best interest of the American people. Remember, Ronald Reagan ran for president on the notion of stabilizing and strengthening the dollar. Back then, oil was cheap. You were paying under a dollar for gasoline. And guess what? The economics of extracting oil stateside made zero sense. Why are we suddenly doing what the most backward nations like Equatorial Guinea, Iran, and other countries around the world can do, extracting oil? Well, we are because every American has suffered a dollar that has been severely shrunken. Look back to what oil cost. Look back what it cost to go to the pump in the 80s and 90s and remind yourself how much your money has been eviscerated. And I say this because, look, there's so much to criticize Biden about, including Biden on dollar policy. But I see red when our side acts like this is something new. Well, this began with George W. Bush, and it began massively under George W. Bush. And it's time that we be honest with ourselves, because we can only have good arguments about our policies if we understand why our side has so consistently been so wrong about them.
Well, I mean, I look back just at gas prices under Trump in his last year as compared to where gas prices are now. And so, I mean, this dollar devaluation has been going on for some time, as you just articulated. And so explain the delta.
Well, yeah, sir, the dollar is weaker since Biden got into office. There's no denying that. To me, I know it's low rent to bring up the gold price, but historically our side has. You know, when Biden got into office, what was gold, the dollar about what, 1/1600th of an ounce of gold, now it's 1/2000th. That is a severe devaluation of the dollar. It also fell under Trump, and so gasoline is certainly more expensive now than it was under Trump, but let's be clear, relative to what it was under Clinton and Reagan, it was wildly expensive under Trump, and it was wildly expensive under Bush. And so my point, again, is that I'm not denying the devaluation under Biden. I just think the bigger story was the lockdowns in terms of prices. In terms of gasoline, this is a 21st century story. And until we come to terms with that, we're going to keep talking about drill, baby, drill, and all this stuff that's really popular on cable news, but that makes no economic sense. We are supposed to be the responsible ones. The challenge right now for oil companies is not just regulation and Biden's alleged war on energy. hey, Bush was an oil man. Why did oil go so much under him? The challenge now is that there's no financing out there to extract oil that you may lose money on once you bring it to market. And it's very expensive to extract oil in the U.S. relative to anywhere else. And that's why historically when oil is cheap, that the U.S. is a non-player in the extraction industry.
He is John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of When Politicians Panic, that is, When Politicians Panicked is the book on COVID. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis continues to stand and deliver in face of the woke mob, including corporate America, when it comes to cultural issues. The latest, as we've discussed on the show previously, is this legislation that's been sent to his desk, which he's going to sign, which prohibits sexual education and sexual identity education in K through 3. It's being termed by its opponents as "Don't Say Gay," which is specious. It's propagandizing. It's sentimental histrionics. And the CEO of Disney, Bob Chapek, has now weighed in opposition to the legislation. And DeSantis has weighed in on Disney.
Does it say that in the bill? Does it say that in the bill? I'm asking you to tell me what's in the bill, because you are pushing false narratives. It doesn't matter what critics say.
Well, it says it bans classroom instruction on sexual identity and gender orientation.
For who? For grades pre-K through 3. So 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds. And the idea that you wouldn't be honest about that and tell people what it actually says, it's why people don't trust people like you, because you peddle false narratives. And so we disabuse you of those narratives. And we're going to make sure that parents are able to send their kid to kindergarten without having some of this stuff injected into their school curriculum.
Companies that have made a fortune off being family friendly and catering to families and young kids, you know, they should understand that parents of young kids do not want this injected into their kids' kindergarten classroom. Our policy is going to be based on the best interest of Florida citizens, not on the musing of woke corporations.
Mm-hmm. A timely movie is out on this topic, broader than just this issue, but it includes this issue. The title of the documentary, which premieres in theaters nationwide today, in theaters today, and then it'll go to the streaming services, is Whose Children Are They? Here's the trailer for this film.
Public education has gone off the rails.
Now it's about power and money and politics, and somehow the kids are getting lost in all of that.
It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you're a mom and a dad first.
Critical race theory is dividing our children in ways that are unacceptable.
You cannot use racism to eradicate racism.
Our teachers are bullied. Parents are shut out.
Less than 1/3 of America's school children are proficient in anything.
They're teaching these kids X-rated sex acts. When we look at this radical agenda, the way our children are being exploited and the way parents are getting shut out, it comes down to one fundamental question. Whose children are they?
Whose children are they?
¿De quién son esos niños?
Whose children are they?
And now we're pleased to be joined by the producer and writer of Whose Children Are They, Deborah Flora. Deborah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here with you. I really appreciate it as well.
So this battle playing out in Florida, and now, by the way, there's legislation circulating in Georgia that's similar and drawing similar outrage from the usual suspects. This is a good example of what your film seeks to address.
Absolutely. And, you know, Governor DeSantis called it out very well. It's a straw man argument. If people stand up against CRT, they say that we don't want the full teaching of history, which is false. We want the real teaching of history, not the ideological agenda based on the 1619 Project. If we want to protect small children as young as, you know, preschool from being sexualized, they say that somehow we are against the LGBT agenda, which we're not. There's a big difference between an adult making the lifestyle choices they want and parents being indoctrinated, in particular, without their parents' knowledge or consent, which is what's happening across America.
And when you're thinking of whose children are they, I mean, the title, you're thinking about that question, I can't help but go back to what Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona said in a committee hearing before Congress when he was asked if parents are the primary stakeholders in their kids' education. And he responded that parents are a stakeholder among many stakeholders. So parents are, you know, included with administrators and teachers and teachers' unions as a stakeholder, but just a stakeholder, not the stakeholder.
Yes, you know, and that's what really brought out this outrage of the title, Whose Children Are They? Because, Dan, I founded Parents Unite in America a few years ago. I am a parent. That is part of this. I spoke out at our school board meeting last summer in Douglas County, Colorado. We flipped the school board. But the reality is there they were having training that got leaked out to us. Nobody let parents see it, where they referred to parents as dissenters. The teacher unions refer to parents as barriers. Well, what we're seeing is an uprising across the country of parents from every walk of life who are stating the reestablishing their rightful place to be the ultimate authority in their children's lives. We believe in partnering with teachers, and the golden triangle of education are teachers and parents standing together for the good of children. But teachers' unions and their ideological partners have inserted themselves in that and have tried to take away the very rights of parents to even know what their children are teaching. And one of the cases that we make in the documentary, Whose Children Are They?, is while academic scores are plummeting all across America, as one of our experts says, you know, in many areas, less than a third of children are proficient in reading and math. Well, when that is happening, they are instead wrapping up indoctrination. It is the job of schools to educate in academic issues, not every single worldview, morality, sexuality. And I have to say, Dan, when people see the documentary, which does premiere nationwide tonight in over 760 theaters, the part that is the most shocking is the sex education portion. As you said, this is comprehensive. It's about CRT, sex education, gender fluidity, anti-discipline, etc. But even the sex education, we have to put a disclaimer in front of it saying this is for mature audiences only, but they're showing it to children across the country.
Well, what was the most egregious thing on sex education that you saw, you know, while producing this film?
Well, for instance, there is a series of animated videos because they say, oh, let's make it age appropriate. So they say, let's make it age appropriate by presenting highly sexualized issues in an animated cartoon. It's a pornographic animated cartoon. And so that is in there. There is a woman who's reading from some books that are training for teachers as well as curriculum, where a small child as young as 9, 10 perhaps, sits there as people call out words of all the slang words for male and female anatomy. It has nothing to do with reproductive biology, and it has everything to do with desensitizing and sexualizing our children.
I mean, we've covered it on this show at the grade school level in Chicagoland, in the suburbs, where you have books that are in the library or books that are part of curriculum that provide detail to, again, grammar school kids about oral sex, anal sex. I mean, it is unbelievably graphic.
It is. I mean, there are things in there that the woman who presents it in our documentary, she is so uncomfortable. And we felt very badly for her to even have to say it. And by the way, she shared this at a school board meeting and was told to stop because it was inappropriate. If it's inappropriate for a school board meeting with adults, you better believe it's inappropriate for 8, 9, 10-year-olds. So there's all sorts of things in there. And then in addition, there's indoctrination things that are happening. For instance, No Place for Hate, it really says its ultimate goal is not to stop bullying. It says move beyond kindness, and it's towards creating social justice warriors. That is not why parents of Democrat background, Republican background, send their kids to school. They send them their kids to school to learn reading, writing, arithmetic, science, math, etc. And unfortunately, this is what's been going on. The reality is we knew what we needed to do is drag it into the light to take this movement to the critical mass and tipping point so that we will see a permanent change in our education system to get back to education, not indoctrination.
Well, how hard was it to find brave teachers to come forward? Because, you know, once this film, you know, is released, which it will be tonight, do any of them have a chance of possibly losing their jobs because of it for coming forward?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, and we want to hear from them if they do. But we do have about 25 brave teachers who speak up in this documentary. We have frontline experts, we have parents, and we have some very brave students. And we're prepared for it. But I tell you, they've all had enough because there are great teachers, and we are pro-teacher. But there are great teachers that are bullied into teaching this or allowing it to be taught in their classrooms because they're told by the teachers unions that if they don't, that they will, you know, be open up to all kinds of lawsuits, etc. We're explaining this to teachers that they also have a choice. They don't have to be in a union for the major teacher unions for their insurance. There's other companies that provide that. Do not force ideological agendas on them. And letting parents know, time to rise up. Vote for school boards that are not union affiliated or getting money from them. Vote for legislators that will pass legislation where the money follows the student and not the system. It's time. And parents are spitting mad, and they are going to change the face of this in this country.
Well, and that's just going back to the so-called Don't Say Gay legislation, too. These Don't Say Gay propagandists. It's so interesting because these are the same people that actually are enforced. There's no such thing as Don't Say Gay. That's not the legislation. Nobody's saying that. But right. there are people saying Don't Say God in school. The parents of a second grader in Des Moines, Washington, found out that school officials repeatedly confronted and reprimanded their little girl, second grader, for discussing her Christian faith with classmates. North Hill Elementary School in Des Moines, Washington. A student was sent to the principal's office, confronted by school staff on multiple occasions for sharing the gospel on the school playground. So that is verboten. You can share that I'm a Christian, but you can and must be exposed to their, as you say, sexualization curriculum in the primary grades.
Yes. Well, that's exactly right. It's heading in one direction. Honestly, there should be no indoctrination of children. If the point is, and this is what they hide behind, it's to stop bullying. All you have to do is teach children to be kind to one another. That means if there's a young child who suddenly goes from Billy to Susie, be kind to Susie. If there's a beautiful young girl named Mary who's Catholic and has ashes on her forehead, be kind to her. If Saeed wears a turban because he's Sikh, be kind to him. That is all we need to do. We do not need to indoctrinate children into any ideology to teach them the golden rule. So they hide behind an agenda when really it is just pushing in one direction, and it's the radicalization. It's from a leftist side, and ultimately it comes down to that question, whose children are they? Because there is a view that it's much more from a Marxist bent, that as Karl Marx said, from the moment a child can be without their mother, they'll be in the care of state institutions. So there's certainly that agenda, but we all know from the founding of our country, our most natural intrinsic rights are the right of a parent to be the ultimate authority in their children's lives. That is what this documentary is about. That is what pushing this movement to the final stage of critical mass. So we do see a taking back of our children's education. Because we're not just a stakeholder, as you were saying, Dan. We are the primary stakeholders. Yes, good citizens, society in general has a vested interest in making sure that the next generation is properly educated. That's why we need to push back towards academics, not indoctrination.
She is Deborah Flora. She's the writer and producer of the documentary Whose Children Are They? Releases today, 750 theaters nationwide, as she said. And then if you can't see it today, it will be on the streaming services. Deborah Flora, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the film.
Yeah, thank you. And everyone go to whosechildrenarethey.com to find a theater near you. That's whosechildrenarethey.com. Thank you so much, Dan and Amy. I really appreciate your having me on the show.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show
is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.